If all at breakfast, you'd have thought something good happened instead of his house nearly going up in flames. He's just relieved it didn't, Livy said. And thank God we came back when we did. If we'd dilly-dallied a little longer at the Prescotts, who would have saved little Charles? I can't bear to think of it.
One hopes that Nanny would have, Pamela said.
Livy shook her head angrily. She'd have been useless. You saw her last night, a quivering jelly.
Well, all's well now, Ben said. And the servants, how are they taking it?
Ruby's still a bit weepy, and none of them like the idea of camping out in the butler's pantry and a disused storeroom, but it's better than the rain coming in onto them, Pamela said, smiling at Ben. Actually, the army chaps have already been round this morning to survey the damage, and they say they can requisition supplies to fix the roof, which is jolly good news. And they offered to make a couple of rooms available in their part of the house for our servants. She chuckled. Ma rejected that offer. She said she wasn't having her girls sleeping anywhere near a pack of soldiers. I think she was quite right. Our parlour-maid is not to be trusted around men, and Ruby could easily be led astray.
"I've just written to Teddy," Livy said. "He'd want to hear that his wife and son were in danger but survived. I just wish he weren't so far away. Why couldn't they let me accompany him to the Bahamas? I wouldn't have got in the way of his duties with the Duke."
"It's a war, Livy," Pamela said. "Think of all those men being shipped around the world, leaving their wives and children behind. There would be no reason for you to get special treatment."
"We are friends of the Duke of Windsor. That should count for something," Livy said stiffly.
"Not very much at the moment. I would say that the Duke of Windsor is more liability than asset," Pamela replied.
"I think he's been very unfairly treated," Livy said.
"Because he took his wife to visit Hitler in his lair?" Pamela demanded. Then she looked up, and her face broke into a smile.
"Look who's coming," she said,
and Ben turned to see the Prescott's sleek rolls coming up the drive. It came to a halt beside them, and Jeremy got out.
"My God, I came as soon as I heard," he said. "We saw the fire last night, but we thought it was that plane that crashed in a field. Then this morning one of the servants came from the village and told us. How much damage was there?"
"Not too bad, really," Livy said.
"Part of the roof was destroyed. The attic was damaged. Grandmama's hideous Victorian monstrosities went up in smoke. You know, stuffed birds and dried flowers and things. The ceiling came down in some of the servants' rooms, but we were extremely lucky having the whole regiment on hand. They put it out in no time at all."
"And what about all of you? Any casualties?"
He was looking at Pamela.
"No, we're all fine, thank you. At least I'm fine, thanks to Ben.
I went up to rescue Phoebe's governess in the east turret. I found her passed out and lying under the bed, and I couldn't move her. The room was rapidly filling with smoke, and the ceiling was coming down. I didn't know what to do. Then Ben arrived, and we were just pulling her out when a great beam fell. He flung himself." Ben was sure she was going to say, "on top of me," but she corrected and said,
"He pushed me out of the way just in time, and together we dragged Miss Gumble to safety."
Jeremy looked at Ben and grinned.
"Not bad, old chap. So you're having your share of excitement after all. Maybe I shouldn't have underestimated you."
"No," Ben said calmly. "You should never do that."
"So all's well that ends well here. Jolly good," Jeremy said. "I say, Pamma, want to come out for a drive? I've finally been allowed to get my hands on the motor car, on the pretext of checking up on you all."
Pamela looked across at Ben.
"I have to go up to London and report in at work," he said. "I just wanted to make sure that everything was all right here." "Can't do without you at work, eh, Ben?" Jeremy asked.
"Jeremy, don't be so horrid," Pamela said. "See how you'll feel if they don't ever let you fly again."
"I didn't mean," Jeremy said.
Yes, you did, Ben replied. But you'll find I'm quite thick-skinned these days. Have a nice drive, you two.
He went over to his bicycle, started to wheel it away, then decided to go and see Miss Gumble in her stable quarters. The room was spartan, to say the least. A single bed, a chest of drawers and some hooks on the wall for clothes. Every surface was currently piled high with books. She was, as Phoebe had reported, a bit weepy.
"It is so good of you to come and visit me, Mr. Cresswell," she said. "I can't thank you enough for saving my life, but so many of my precious books have been destroyed, my whole life taken from me."
"I'm so sorry," he said. "Maybe more of them will be salvageable than you think."
"But my papers. I had hoped to finish my thesis. My former Oxford tutor said that he would petition for me to present it to the examiners. I had to leave Oxford, you know, when my father died and my brother turned me out without a penny to my name."
"Yes, Phoebe told me," he said. "I'm very sorry." She nodded.
"Life isn't always fair. Why should Farley be hit by a bomb?"
Ben was looking around the room, trying to bring the subject back to telescopes.
"I don't see your telescope," he said. "I hope you managed to salvage that."
"Oh, yes, thank you. It's hard to destroy a telescope. It was my father's. Good, solid British brass."
"Were you studying the stars?" he said. She laughed.
"Oh, goodness gracious, no. It's just a little telescope. I indulge in a little bird-watching. I had it trained on a blackbird's nest in a big oak tree. There was a cuckoo in it. I find cuckoos fascinating, don't you? They lay their eggs in others' birds' nests. And then their young one is so much bigger, and it pushes the real chicks out, so that the poor blackbirds have only it to feed." She shuddered. "Life is so cruel. I shan't bother to set my telescope up here. There is no view of the woods, only the stable yard."
Ben was glad to make his escape. The telescope and the papers all sounded completely plausible. But then he had been told during his briefings that women make good spies. As he was wheeling his bicycle away, he remembered the papers that were drying in the conservatory. Miss Gumble was busy arranging things in her new quarters, so he had a good chance to take a peek at them. He made his way around the house to the conservatory on the other side. In the old days, before the war, there would have been a pack of gardeners. Now there were only a couple of old men trying to keep things going. There was no sign of either of them as he approached the conservatory and let himself in. Inside was the sweet, moist smell of growing plants. He noticed small grapes on the grapevine in the corner and small tomato plants with yellow blooms on them. And there on the long table were the books and papers, some of them still a soggy mess beyond hope. On others the ink had run. He bent over them, trying to read the writing. Then he stiffened. He read the words, "Wars of the Roses." He didn't find a date, but words leaped off the page. "Struggled to replace a weak king with a more vibrant branch of the Plantagenet dynasty. Two branches of the royal line. Final battle. Outcome of the battle was defeat of the royal." Was it just coincidence that he had taken the numbers 1461 to be a date during the Wars of the Roses? Or was it possible there was some hidden message here? Two branches of the royal family. Defeat of the weaker line. The king who stammered. The king who was anti-Hitler. Was there possibly a plot to get rid of the king? He looked through the rest of the papers, but couldn't find anything that was obviously incriminating. Then he wondered if Miss Gumble might be working for the other side and sending and receiving messages with a hidden radio. In which case, why did they find it necessary to have someone parachute down with a photograph in his pocket? Back at the vicarage, he changed into city clothes and then cycled to the station. By now, word had spread around the whole village, and Ben was bombarded with questions about his role in last night's drama as he came upon a group of women chatting outside the bakery.
"So it really was a bomb, was it?" one of the women called out to him. "We wondered if it was just a normal house fire."
"No, it was definitely a bomb," Ben said.
"Why would anyone want to bomb Farley?"
a woman asked.
"Maybe because it's one of them stately homes,"
another woman muttered.
"You know what those devils are like. They want to scare us into capitulating by bombing everything that matters to us.
But they're mistaken. We can end up with rubble all around us, and we won't give in."
Ben looked at her weathered and wrinkled face, a woman whose life had been of the uttermost simplicity, who had probably never ventured past Sevenoaks or Tunbridge, and yet willing to stand up to a mighty enemy against all odds.
"We might even beat them some day," Ben thought.
He was just mounting his bicycle again when a van drew up beside him. Baxter's Builders was painted on the side. Billy Baxter wound down the window and leaned out.
"Going somewhere, Ben?"
"To the station," Ben replied. "I have to report in to work."
"Jump in. I'll give you a lift."
"It's all right, thanks," Ben replied. "I'm quite capable of riding my bike to the station."
Billy grinned.
"What, that old thing? Looks like it will fall into pieces before you get round the bend." "It's lasted at least 30 years, so I expect it will keep going a little while longer."
"Come on, don't be standoffish.
I'm heading that way myself." "And what if you come back and it's pouring with rain?"
Ben hesitated. Of course, he'd rather ride in the van than pedal the ancient bike to the station, but this was Billy Baxter.
"Come to think of it, I could take you right into Sevenoaks. Then you wouldn't have to change trains," Billy said.
"I'd take it if I were you, Ben," one of the women said. "Leave your bike, and we'll see it gets back to the vicarage."
Now he had no option.
"All right, thanks," he said, nodding to the woman.
He went around to the passenger side and climbed in beside Billy. They drove off.
"Where are you heading, then?" Ben asked.
"Going into the lumber yard on the other side of Sevenoaks," he said.
"I reckon I'll need to stock up after what happened at Farley last night."
"You were there, were you?
Is there a lot of work to be done?"
"Quite a bit," Ben said, "but I think the army has it all in hand."
"Since it's now temporarily a military post, I heard they are requisitioning supplies to rebuild."
It gave him the greatest pleasure to watch Billy's face.
"But they'll still need a qualified builder, won't they?" he said, "unless they plan to make do with a few boards tacked across to keep the rain out."
Ben didn't answer this, but said,
"You seem to be doing quite well out of the war."
"Not too badly, old son. You've got to take your chances, haven't you? Make the most of things."
"It's a pity there aren't more houses being bombed in the Kentish countryside," Ben said.
"I have enough work to keep me going for the duration, don't you worry. And some nice little bits on the side, too."
"Bits on the side?"
"I have a petrol ration, see? I have to get around to repair bomb damage, and the nice government gives me extra coupons, so I can pick up and deliver. Tell your dad if he ever wants anything, he only has to come to me."
"Black market, you mean?" Ben asked.
Billy grinned.
"Supply and demand. Doing a good service, old son. I help those who have superfluous goods load them off to someone who needs them."
"With a good mark-up for you in the middle."
The grin widened.
"I'm not a right mug, you know."
So that ruled out Billy Baxter as a possible German contact, Ben thought. He was profiting so nicely from the war, he probably didn't want it to end. And if the Germans invaded, he'd be the sort who'd keep them supplied with necessities too. He was glad when they reached the station and parted cordially.
Chapter 25 At Dolphin Square.
then waited in the lobby for the lift to arrive, trying to compose in his mind what he wanted to say to Maxwell Knight. Had he anything of substance to report, apart from a bomb falling on Farley, Miss Gumbel's telescope, the two artists in the Oast House? The lift came down and the doors opened. Ben uttered a gasp at the same time Guy Harcourt said,
"My God, Cresswell, what a surprise!"
"What are you doing here?" Ben demanded.
"I could ask you the same thing, old chap," Guy said.
"Let's just say we're both on the same side, shall we?"
"I never did buy that nervous breakdown and having to take time offline. You're as fit as I am. So it seems we both have a standing invitation with a certain captain at Dolphin Square. Well, well."
"Good God, you too," Ben said.
"Let's just say I'm happy to oblige as messenger boy when asked. You'll be back at our digs, will you?"
"I'm not sure," Ben said. "I, too, run errands." He grinned and stepped into the open lift. He took a deep breath and walked down the hallway to the office. Maxwell Knight was dressed, this time, in a smart army uniform. Ben was ushered into the inner sanctum.
"Come in, Cresswell."
Knight looked up from his paperwork.
"Take a seat."
"I'm sorry, sir. I didn't realize you were an army officer," he said. "I should have been addressing you by your correct rank." Knight returned his gaze.
"I'm not, if you really want to know, but I felt I was doing as much as any member of the armed forces to end this war, so I decided I had as much right as any man to wear a uniform."
Then he grinned, looking suddenly boyish.
"I even awarded myself a couple of medals."
He pointed to the strip of ribbon on his chest.
"This one is for rescuing badgers. This one is for making a frightfully good martini."
Then Knight's face became solemn again.
"You have something to report already?"
"I'm not sure, sir. Farley was hit by a bomb last night."
"Was it now? Much damage?"
"Luckily, not too bad. The attic caught on fire, and some of the top-floor rooms are not habitable at the moment, but no casualties, thank God. The army chaps helped put it out quickly, and, of course, the building is mainly built of stone."
"That's it?"
Knight asked, his lip curling in what Ben took to be a sarcastic smile. "I've done a recce of the neighbourhood, and have a list here of possible persons of interest. Nothing too promising, I'm afraid." He handed Knight a sheet of paper. Knight studied it. "Lord Westerham's oldest daughter, Olivia, is married to Viscount Carrington, who is chummy with the Duke of Windsor and with him in the Bahamas. She thinks the Duke has been unfairly treated, but I get no hint from her that she might actively want to aid the Germans. In fact, between you and me, she has always struck me as the least bright of the girls, and easily panicked. I can't see her having the nerves to be a spy." Knight grinned again.
"Women make the best actors, you know," he said. "But you've known her all your life, so I'll take your word for it." He paused. "Who else?"
"I put Lady Phoebe's governess on the list. She's an educated woman, good family, supposedly writing her thesis. But she did have a telescope in her window in the turret room, and she was very possessive about her papers. I wondered if perhaps she might be studying aircraft and flight paths from Biggin Hill Aerodrome, and then somehow signalling them to Germany." Knight nodded.
"Interesting.
Yes, she's just the sort of person they might use. Disgruntled, feels that life has cheated her. Maybe wants to get back at the British establishment."
"She seems nice and genuine enough," Ben said.
"She claims to use her telescope for bird-watching."
"Does she?"
Maxwell Knight smiled.
"Maybe you should follow up on her. Get a look at her papers. Search her room to see if there is a hidden radio."
"I've been through her papers that were damaged in the bombing, and they all seem to relate to a historical thesis she is writing, except for one interesting fact. They are about the Wars of the Roses, and two of the biggest battles of that war were in 1461, so I wondered if that might be a coincidence.
Interesting, Knight nodded. I'm not a great believer in coincidence myself. I'd follow up on her, search her room more thoroughly if I were you.
Yes, sir. Then thought of this assignment with distaste.
And anyone else raised a red flag?
Ben took a deep breath.
There are some people in the area who seem to be doing remarkably well in spite of war, but then I don't think they'd want to bring it to a speedy close. Oh, and I met a couple last night who seem to have pro-German tendencies and are also supporters of the Duke of Windsor, Lord and Lady Musgrove. They're on the list. He has just inherited a property and come from Canada. They seem to have plenty of money and enough petrol coupons to drive around. Nobody in the neighbourhood knew anything of them until recently, which made me wonder if they are who they claim to be. But they live at least 5 or 6 miles away, so why not parachute into their field?
Why not indeed? Knight echoed.
Apart from those, there are 2 foreign artists who have recently come to live in a converted Osthaus. One claims to be Danish, the other Russian. They seem to be a little too self-absorbed to be spies. But there was one thing. There was a piece of artwork on the wall that the Russian claimed as his own, but it was actually from another well-known artist.
"We'll do some checking," Knight said.
"Foreigners have to register, so it should be simple to find out.
Is that it?"
"Only a Jewish surgeon from Vienna, who is staying with our local GP. There are naturally rumours about him because he speaks with a German accent, but he was telling me about being persecuted in Austria. Again, he came to this country recently, so should be easy to verify. Oh, and an Austrian land girl who is going out with one of the soldiers. That could be an easy way of getting information."
Knight looked up from the paper.
"And what about local gossip? Anything juicy there?"
"People seem to think that the parachutist was a German spy, probably come to spy on Biggin Hill Aerodrome."
"Good work."
Knight folded the sheet of paper.
"So what next?"
"I take it that the place in the photograph hasn't been identified yet?"
Ben asked.
"Not yet."
"Then I have a couple of suggestions," Ben said. "I mentioned that the numbers on the photograph could refer to a date in history and the Wars of the Roses. There were 2 major battles, one on the Welsh border and one in Yorkshire. I wondered if I should take a look at the battle sites and see if they resembled the terrain in the picture."
"By all means," Knight said. "No stone left unturned, eh?"
Ben hesitated.
"Would I be entitled to travel vouchers? Official reason for travel, that sort of thing?"
"Absolutely not," Knight said.
"This office does not exist, Cresswell.
Nothing leaves this office that can be traced back to us. Keep track of your expenses and we'll reimburse you."
Ben stood up. Clearly, he was being dismissed. He wanted to ask about Guy Harcourt. To drop a hint that he knew Guy was also some part of Knight's stable, but he thought that protocol probably required that nobody claimed to know anyone else.
"Oh, and Cresswell," Knight said, "you don't have to stint. Stay somewhere decent. Treat yourself to a good meal for once."
Ben paused at the doorway, turning back to Knight, who had swiveled his chair to face the vista along the Thames.
"Excuse me, sir," he said, "but I couldn't help wondering if the bomb had anything to do with the other incident."
Knight swiveled back.
"The parachutist, you mean? What are your thoughts on that?"
"I'm not sure what to think. But when 2 separate enemy actions take place within a few yards of each other, one has to wonder if they have something in common. So it did occur to me to wonder if the parachutist had been sent to assassinate somebody, and having failed, the house was bombed." He paused as Knight said nothing.
"I know it sounds absurdly outlandish, but..."
"Not at all," Knight said.
Do you think Lord Westerham or any of his daughters would be worth the risk of sending down a parachutist to kill them?
Frankly, no, sir.
Knight took a deep breath. I think it's most likely that they now have the house pinpointed as an army base. Not too hard to spot the army vehicles in the front garden, even though they do have camouflage over them. So maybe this was a warning bomb that they know the West Kents are headquartered there, and they will be back.
Yes, sir. That's the conclusion I came to.
He turned to go again. On the other hand, Maxwell Knight said, there is something you should know about Lord Westerham's family. I don't think it could have any connection to our parachutist or the bomb. However, Lady Margot Sutton has been taken by the Gestapo in Paris.
Crikey,
Ben blurted out before he realized how juvenile that sounded. He felt the color drain from his face.
They've taken Margot because of her French lover.
Possibly, Maxwell Knight said. Also, possibly because she was one of ours.
A spy? Margot was a spy?
In a very minor sort of way. She went to the embassy while it was still in operation and asked that since she was stuck in Paris, could she be of any assistance? She was given a secret radio and passed messages along the chain. If they have found the radio, they will probably torture her and then shoot her.
Is there to be no attempt to try and get her out? Ben asked.
Being arranged as we speak, Knight said. Sir, I'd like to volunteer to be part of that mission, Ben said.
Knight actually grinned.
I admire your pluck and your loyalty, but I suspect that if your leg was working properly, you'd be up flying a Spitfire by now. Can you really see yourself clambering over Paris rooftops, shinning down drainpipes and running from German soldiers, firing over your shoulder as you go?
Ben opened his mouth to speak, but Knight went on.
And for that matter, can you see yourself calmly slitting the throat of a sentry on guard? It takes a particular type of chap to be able to carry out assignments like that. That's why we leave it to the commandos. They are trained.
Does her family know any of this?
No, and you are not to tell them until the mission is conducted satisfactorily. If it is not, we will decide on the right time and place to inform them.
Ben nodded.
Might I ask that you let me know how the mission went? Possibly. We'll have to see.
He waved at Ben.
Go on. Off you go on your quest, then.
As Ben left the office, he noticed that Maxwell Knight's secretary, Joan Miller, was as smartly dressed as if she were going for a meal at the Savoy. Grey silk and pearls, and a touch of makeup.
"You look very nice today, Miss Miller," he said. She smiled.
"Why, thank you, Mr. Cresswell. I have a date with some important gentleman. One has to look one's best on such occasions."
As Ben came out into the fresh air, he shook his head. There was always an Alice in Wonderland-like quality about visiting Dolphin Square. He found himself wondering if either of the people there were real. He also found himself wondering if his assignment was of any value.
Chapter 26 At Bletchley Park. On Sunday evening, Pamela caught the train back to Bletchley. Jeremy had offered to drive her. He had just driven her home after an evening at a pub on the banks of the Medway. It was a romantic setting, but the food left much to be desired. The cod was like leather, and the cabbage boiled to a grey mass. They had laughed about it and compared it to the food at Nethercote.
"Must you go back to work?" he asked.
"Of course. It was quite out of order to allow me a week when we are so short-handed, but I was suffering from the effects of too many night shifts and didn't really get a proper break last Christmas."
"Then we'll go together. I've got to go up to town anyway. I have to see the quacks at Bart's to make sure my gunshot wound has healed nicely and that I'm fit to report back for duty."
He must have noticed the look of alarm on Pamela's face.
"Oh, not back to flying, old thing. Much as I wish, I don't think I'll be allowed in an aeroplane for a few more months. But they say they'll find something for me at the Air Ministry. I can't say I'm looking forward to it. From what you and Ben say, they only allow you to do the routine stuff. I want to be able to plot the courses for bombing raids or interpret aerial photographs."
"You would," Pamela laughed. "But the boring stuff has to be done too, Jeremy. If files were not in apple pie order and a piece of information couldn't be found the moment it's wanted, the delay could cost lives."
"You're right." He grinned back at her. "I never was much good at doing the ordinary things, was I? I got beaten enough times at school for failing to buckle down and study. But then I aced the exams, and they had to eat their words. Most satisfying."
"You shouldn't waste petrol driving up to town when there is a perfectly good train," Pamela said.
"Oh, don't worry. My father can virtually write himself petrol coupons, you know. He has to go up to town all the time."
Pamela had a worrying vision of Jeremy insisting on driving her all the way to Bletchley. That would never do.
"I'd appreciate a ride to the station," she said, "but I think I'd rather go back by train after that. I have the voucher to travel."
"Anyone would think you were trying to avoid me."
"Not at all, Jeremy. I love being with you. You know that. We've had a splendid time together, haven't we? It's just that, well, I want to get my head in order before I check back to work. For all I know, I might have to go directly to another night shift."
"They've no right making women do night shifts," Jeremy said. "I think I'll come with you and tell them."
"No, you won't," she slapped his hand.
He grabbed her hand, pulled her toward him, and kissed her with passion, gradually forcing her back onto the seat of the rolls. She was horribly conscious of his weight on top of her, his tongue in her mouth, his knee forcing her legs apart, his hand straying downward. She sat up abruptly, pushing his hand away.
"Jeremy, not here, outside my parents' house. Anyone might see."
He was looking at her, long and hard.
"Hammer, I'm beginning to wonder whether you still feel anything for me. You used to love me, I know you did. My feelings for you haven't changed, you know. I can't help admitting that I want you. I want you desperately, and yet every time I get near you, you push me away."
"I don't mean to," she said, "and I do still love you. I dreamed about you every day you were away. I went to sleep with your picture under my pillow, and I do want you to make love to me. It's just..."
She gave an embarrassed little laugh.
"I'm a 21-year-old virgin, and I'm hesitant to take that next step, I suppose."
He laughed now.
"Then we'll have to do something about that, won't we?"
"I won't rush you. I'll make sure the time and place are right."
"Our London flat is very comfortable and very private. Mayfair and all that. No family to spy on us. I'll be moving in at the end of the week. You will come and visit me, won't you?"
"I don't know when I'll get more time off," she said, "but I will come."
"We can start with my moving-in party. I thought I might hold it next Wednesday. That will give me time to get settled in. Do you have your evenings free?"
"It depends what shift I am on."
He frowned.
"Surely you can swap shifts for one evening. You don't have to work 7 days a week, do you?"
"No, of course not."
"And you can get into town by train?"
"Yes, easily."
He took her hand in his, playing with her fingers.
"Then let's say next Wednesday. I haven't had a decent party for years. Invite your friends if you like. I bet the old man has some good booze stashed away at the flat. We'll help him drink it in case the Germans invade and confiscate it."
Pamela was sitting up very straight in the car, wanting to smooth down her skirt.
"Do you think they will invade?"
"I think it's inevitable," he said. "Look how easily they walked into France and Belgium and Denmark and Norway. What have we got that those countries don't have?"
"We haven't been invaded since 1066, she said.
Napoleon walked into all those countries, but he couldn't take Britain.
He patted her knee.
That's the spirit. We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them in the pubs and public loos.
Jeremy, don't make fun. It was a brilliant speech. Mr. Churchill is a brilliant orator.
Sorry. Yes, I know he is. But with all the fighting spirit and pride in the world, we don't have the weapons to take on the Wehrmacht. If America decides to lend us some, then that may be different. But they may sit on the fence for years.
Pamela shuddered. Let's not talk about it. You're home safe, and that's what matters.
And you'll come to my party.
I'll try my best to, I promise.
Pamela went over this conversation in her head as the train bore her out from London to Bletchley. A party? That would be safe enough. Safety in numbers. Then she realized at some point she'd have to come to terms with her relationship with Jeremy. He wanted to make love to her. She had always thought that she wanted it too. But her vision included marriage. His didn't seem to. She'd heard too many rumours of girls who ended up in the family way. Girls who were shipped off to the country and nobody ever spoke about the baby again.
"But Jeremy would marry me if that happened," she thought. "Of course he would. Besides," she added to herself, "I have a feeling that Jeremy knows about such things."
She was feeling better by the time she returned to Bletchley and found she was anxious to get back to work. Trixie was sitting on her bed when Pamela arrived back at their digs. She was carefully easing one leg into a silk stocking. She looked up and smiled.
"Oh, you're back! Just a minute while I try to do this without laddering my one good pair. God knows what I'll do after this. Resort to drawing a line up the back of my leg with a pencil like everyone else, I suppose."
She eased the stocking up and secured it with a suspender.
"Did you have a good time?"
"Yes, thank you, apart from our house being bombed."
"Bombed? Golly, how awful! Was it destroyed?"
"No, thank goodness. Only very minor damage. The West Kent Regiment is billeted with us, and it was a case of all hands to the rescue. They put out the fire before it could spread." Trixie grinned.
"I really must come and visit you with all those yummy soldiers on the premises. Speaking of yummy men, did you see the delicious Jeremy Prescott?"
"I did."
"And how is he? Is he, fully recovered?"
"Still a little pale and thin, but well on the road to recovery, thank God. He looks a little like a romantic poet, you know, like Keats on his deathbed, but recovering rapidly." An image of Jeremy in the car, trying to pin her down, flashed across her mind.
"Yes,
making a remarkable recovery."
"So did you have an absolutely divine time? Confess all. Tell Auntie Trixie."
"We had family around most of the time," Pamela said. "We did go out to dinner at a pub, and then he drove me home."
"Oh, God, I remember going home in a taxi with him once after a Debs ball," Trixie said. "My dear, I had no idea you could get up to that sort of thing in the back of a taxi. Nobody had mentioned he was N.S.I.T.
"What?" Pamela asked.
"N.S.I.T. Not safe in taxis, darling. It was a common code among Debs. Did you grow up in a nunnery?"
"No, but Farley was almost as bad. My parents are horribly prudish, and I knew nothing until I went away to finishing school in Switzerland,
where I'm sure you learned more than how to curtsy and hostess dinner parties. I know I did."
She gave a knowing grin.
"My dear, those ski instructors, so virile."
And she pretended to fan herself. Pamela laughed, a little nervously.
"So did Jeremy pop the question, or did you already have an understanding, as they used to say so quaintly?"
Pamela felt herself flushing.
"Jeremy thinks that one can't think of marriage until this horrid war is over."
"Quite right," Trixie said.
"And who would want to get married when clothing is on ration? You won't see me getting married in a frumpy two-piece. I want the 12-foot train, the veil, and yards of glorious silk, and a yummy trousseau, too."
"You'll be wearing white, then?" Pamela asked, raising an eyebrow and making Trixie giggle.
My dear, if the only brides who wore white were virgins, you'd have very few white weddings, she said.
As she talked, she was pulling on the second stocking. Then she stood up, studied the result in the mirror, and nodded approvingly.
Are you going somewhere nice? Pamela asked.
Probably not. A chap from Hut 6 I met at the concert last night invited me to the pictures. He's a bit serious and brainy for my taste, but then who isn't at this dump? Nobody exactly comes here to have fun, do they? So I thought the pictures would be better than staying in and eating Mrs. Entwistle's cottage pie. And by the way, the food has been particularly drear this week. Boiled cabbage, mashed spuds, and a slice of spam 3 nights in a row. I kept thinking of you, eating real food. Did you have some good meals?
I did, actually, Pamela said.
Especially one at the Prescott's. Oysters and roast pork and chocolate mousse, and all the right wines for each course. I thought I'd die from happiness.
Where did they get their hands on all that?
Black market, by the sound of it. Sir William seems to have fingers in a lot of pies.
Then you'd better force Jeremy to marry you before some other girl snaps him up, if you want to live in luxury for the rest of your life.
She applied a generous coat of lipstick.
So when will you see him again, do you think? It's rather too far to pop down to Kent on a day off, isn't it?
Well, he's moving to his parents' flat in London this week, Pamela said.
He starts work at the Air Ministry.
Oh, and he's planning a party a week from Wednesday. A sort of flat warming. I just hope I'm not still on night duty. Maybe I can trade shifts.
A party? How divine. Can I come?
Pamela hesitated. Trixie would be only too anxious to get her hands on Jeremy again, she was sure, but she saw no reason to decline.
Yes, yes, of course, she said.
If we can both get a free evening. I told Jeremy I might still be working the night shift, and it might be hard to get time off.
Maybe not, Trixie said. I was handed a note from Commander Travis on Friday. He wants you to report straight to him as soon as you come back.
Golly, Pamela said. I hope it's not a reprimand.
Why, you haven't blotted your copybook, have you?
Trixie asked.
Given away state secrets? Talked about your job here, God forbid?
No, of course not. Although it was rather hard at home. They all think I'm doing some boring office job in a faceless ministry, and I couldn't tell them what we are really doing is important.
Is it?
Trixie asked.
Sometimes I wonder. All I do is a boring office job in a faceless ministry, but I suppose your job must be more exciting than mine.
Not exciting, Pamela said hastily, but at least I know I'm a small cog in a long chain that does make a difference, and that's all that matters.
Is this where I stand up, wave a flag, and sing Rule Britannia?
Trixie said, laughing. Pamela gave her a friendly shove.
Shut up and go off to your pictures.
I suppose I'd better go downstairs and face Mrs. Entwistle's spam and spuds.
Chapter 27 At Bletchley Park. At 8 o'clock the next morning, Pamela parked her bike outside the big house and headed for the imposing front door. It was a glorious day. The sun sparkled from the lake where swans glided. Pigeons fluttered and wheeled in the sky. The air smelled of roses and honeysuckle. It was the sort of day to take a picnic to a river bank. Pamela's thoughts went to lazy summer days at Farley before she wrenched them firmly back to the present and entered the gloom of the front hall. She couldn't think of what she might have done wrong, except for fainting. Maybe she was about to be told she wasn't up to the task here and would be sent home in disgrace. But then she wasn't the first person who had fainted or even had a nervous collapse while working here. The long hours, the dreary conditions, and the constant pressure got to other people she knew. The receptionist popped out of her cubby when she heard Pamela's feet on the tiled floor.
"Ah, Lady Pamela," she said.
Do go up. I'll telephone Commander Travis and tell him you are coming.
She had sounded bright and cheerful, which was encouraging, but maybe receptionists knew few details about visitors. She went up the ornate wooden staircase and tapped on the commander's door.
"Lady Pamela," he said jovially, "do take a seat. Did you have a good week's rest at home?"
Pamela perched on an upright chair facing the commander's mahogany desk.
"I did, thank you, sir. A few nights' sleep and good food, and now I'm right as rain." "Splendid," he said, "because I'll need you to be on your toes. I'm giving you a new assignment. It's a little out of the ordinary, even for Bletchley, and nobody else is to know about it. Do you understand? I know you are used to secrecy by now, but in this case it is especially important."
"I see, sir," she said. He leaned forward in his seat.
"What do you know about the new British Broadcasting Corporation?"
"Isn't it a radio station broadcasting from Germany, purporting to be British and giving bogus news?"
"Precisely." He wagged a finger at her, emphasizing the point. "Designed to put fear and despair into the hearts of the British people, to break down their will to fight and to welcome the Germans when they invade."
"I don't think many Britons are taken in by it, sir," she said.
"You'd be surprised. Some people believe anything the radio tells them. They all are not as sophisticated as we are. But that's beside the point. You may have heard that there are fifth columnists working inside Britain. Not necessarily foreigners, but Englishmen and women who, for reasons of their own, are in sympathy with Germany and would like to assist Herr Hitler in any way they can."
"Surely not, sir," Pamela asked. "I mean, one hears about fifth columnists, but one always thinks of dubious Russian émigrés and, of course, Oswald Mosley's fascists."
"You'd be surprised how many people would welcome the invasion," he said. "Even people that you and I know. In fact, we think there is some sort of plot going on at this very moment. We're not sure what it is, but we suspect it may well be to remove the royal family and bring back the Duke of Windsor in their place. We know he has strong pro-German sympathies. He has already demonstrated that."
"Gosh, that would be awful," she blurted out, realizing she sounded like a schoolgirl.
"This is where you come in, Lady Pamela," Commander Travis said. "I have had good reports on you from your team leaders. You are quick and you spot things. You think outside the box. So this is your assignment. We have a nearby radio receiving station where WRAF workers listen and transcribe all German radio broadcasts. You will receive daily transcripts from this new British broadcasting station, and your job will be to pick out anything that might be a message in code to sympathetic souls. It might be a repeated phrase that announces the next sentences will be a message. I can't tell you what to look for because I don't know. But you're sharp. I think I'm right to put you up for the job."
"Will I still be working in my old hut, sir?"
"No, of course not. As I said, this is just between the two of us. Nobody else must know. It is quite possible there are sympathizers here at Bletchley."
"Really?"
"One can't be naive, Lady Pamela. The Abwehr is not stupid. They will attempt to infiltrate sympathizers wherever they can. So you see the need for complete secrecy."
"Of course. But what am I to say to the chaps I was working with if I meet them in the cafeteria? What about my roommate?"
"You tell them you've been seconded for a special assignment with Commander Travis because he says he likes to see a pretty face doing the filing."
She had to laugh at this.
"So I'll be working here." "You will. I'm making a room on the top floor available. And you will report to me and to me only. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir. I hope I can live up to your expectations," she said. "I'm to be working alone, then?"
"No, you will have one colleague working with you.
A very bright young man who will be checking out other German broadcasts for possible coded messages. I hope you'll help each other in discovering possibly coded messages among the harmless ones, and then being able to break those codes. When Pamela said nothing, he added, I have full confidence in you. I think you're the right person for this job.
When do you want me to start? She asked.
He smiled, making his severe face look positively human for a second. No time like the present, Lady Pamela. Pamela left his office and went up another flight of stairs to the designated room on the top floor. This had clearly been a servant's quarters. The hallway was not wood-panelled, and it had a disused feel to it, dusty and stuffy. She opened the door, then let out a little gasp because there was a movement to her right. A tall, gangly fellow jumped up from the table at which she was sitting.
"Golly, you made me jump," Pamela said, laughing now. "I didn't expect anyone to be here. You must be my partner in crime."
He came around the table, holding out his hand to her.
"Froggy Braithwaite," he said. "And you're Lady Pamela Sutton?"
"Correct," she said.
"I take it your name isn't really Froggy." "To the top brass, I have to answer to Reginald," he said. "But I was dubbed Froggy at Winchester, and it has stuck. And you may not remember, but we've met before. I believe I danced with you at one of the dead balls during your season. You probably still have the bruises to prove it."
"I thought you looked familiar," she said.
"And I'm sure you weren't the only partner to tread on my toes during that season. They give girls dancing lessons, but never think of doing the same for their partners. Speaking of which, I'm so glad we're to be working together. This whole thing sounds horribly daunting, and I wouldn't have liked to tackle it alone."
"You must be really bright, or they'd never have asked a woman to do this," he said.
"In case you haven't noticed, the men get all the plum jobs here, and the women are stuck with the clerical stuff, even though they are often better qualified."
"I was one of the lucky ones," Pamela said. "I was doing something quite interesting, but not actual code-breaking. I've no idea how to even start doing that. You'll have to teach me."
He pointed to the teleprinter printouts on the table. "The first batch of transcripts have been sent over from Station Y," he said. "Let's have a look together, and I may be able to show you what we might be looking for."
They stood together at the table. Pamela's eyes scanned the first page. "Dear friends in Britain, we are sorry that your thoughtless government is making you suffer needlessly. The invasion will go ahead as planned, and there is nothing you can do to stop the might of the German Wehrmacht. But those who assist us, who make us welcome, will find that it will be a smooth transition, and life will quickly return to normal. Lights will come on again, pubs and cinemas will reopen, there will be plenty of food again."
"What rubbish!" Pamela exclaimed, making Froggy chuckle. "Surely nobody can believe this," she said.
"You'd be surprised," he replied, "especially when you hear news items like this." He pointed lower down the page. "The Bank of England is perpetuating a giant fraud on the British people. The pound note has actually become worthless, and the government is printing..." They read on. "Reports on the number of British ships sunk, cargo ships that would never reach British shores with food supplies. Britain would soon face starvation. And yet there was a secret store of food in the cellars under Whitehall, so that the members of the government and those in power still eat well, while the average worker has to exist on bread made from sawdust. After the depressing and deceptive news bulletins, there came purposed messages from British servicemen held captive in German stalags. From Sergeant Jimmy Bolton, RAF Hornchurch, and now a prisoner at Stalag 16. To his wife, Minnie. Don't worry about me, old girl. I am in good health and being fed and taken care of here. Chin up, and I'll be home soon."
"I wouldn't hold my breath if I were his wife," Froggy muttered.
Pamela nodded.
"All very insidious and depressing," she said. "But I don't see anything that seems like a coded message. There is nothing like, 'The hedgehog comes out at midnight,' that I had expected to find." He laughed. "The Germans are quite sophisticated with their codes. Let's see if the first letters of any sentence spell any useful words." They did that, but drew a blank. They tried similar combinations, the second sentence of every bulletin. Proper names of the purported prisoners. "I suppose Bolton is a place," Pamela suggested. Froggy shook his head. "But Sims and Johnson aren't, are they? I must say that nothing leaps out at me so far. No repeated words or phrases. We might have to see several days' worth of transcripts to determine if phrases are repeated at the same time each day." By the end of the first day, Pamela felt that they had overestimated her capabilities, and she would soon be found lacking and sent back to her unit in disgrace. When she arrived home, Trixie was waiting for her.
"So, what was it all about? Do tell. Did Commander Travis give you a slap on the wrist?"
"No, nothing like that," Pamela said. "It was just to move me to a new division. We were overstaffed where I was, and they needed extra help with the office work at the big house. As Commander Travis put it, he likes to see a pretty face around the place." Trixie shook her head.
"Men," she said. "Wouldn't it be funny if a woman said, 'Hire a young man. I like to see rippling muscles around the place.'"
Pamela laughed. "I'm sure some women in positions of authority do think that way. But I have to say, I'm glad to be out of that hut. If the big noises work in the main house, you can bet that it will be heated properly in the winter, and I'm close enough to the cafeteria to pop over during my breaks."
"But still only doing the boring stuff, like me," Trixie said.
"When will they realize that we women are capable and could quite easily take on code-breaking like the men?"
"Only if they ever become desperate, I suppose," Pamela said. "Actually, there are some really brainy chaps here, so I understand. Absolute maths whizzes. I wasn't bad at mathematics, but there was no way I'd ever daydream about new ways to solve algebraic problems and have numbers dancing around in my head like some of these boys."
"Some of them are half balmy, if you ask me," Trixie said. "That chap who took me to the pictures, he made a weird sort of humming noise at the back of his throat and kept tapping his foot nervously, and he never got any farther than sliding his arm around my shoulder. We're probably the only normal people here."
Pamela was about to say that she was working with a chap she danced with as a deb, but then remembered that even such trivial matters had to remain secret. A gong sounded.
"I suppose we'd better go down and face the supper," she said. "I'm rather afraid I smelled fish boiling."
"Oh, no, not her dreaded boiled fish," Trixie said. "At least she couldn't overcook spam. Do you think we dare sneak out and go have a sausage roll and a pint at the pub?"
"What, and incur her wrath and be served the most gristly bits of stewed meat forever? Have you noticed that she always gives that creepy man, Mr. Campion, the best bits?"
"Of course I have. She fancies him. But, unfortunately, he doesn't fancy her. I mean, darling, who would?"
She gave a bright laugh. Then she became serious again. "There have to be better digs somewhere nearby. I'd ask my family if we have any connections around here, but I can't reveal where I am. I shall be furious if I find an aged uncle is living 5 miles away in a stately home and eating pheasant 3 times a week.
She slipped her arm through Pamela's. "All right, let's go down and face the music, or rather face the boiled cod. Then we'll go and get that pint. My treat."
Chapter 28 At Home and Abroad with Ben. Back home after his visit to London, Ben felt uncomfortable about searching Miss Gumbel's room. It wouldn't be too hard, he realized. She'd likely be with Phoebe, giving her lessons during the morning. But all the same, there was a tremendous risk. Everyone in the house knew him. If he bumped into any member of the family, he'd have to come up with a reason for being there and possibly be taken into the house for tea. If he was seen going up the steps to the flat over the stables, he'd have to explain himself.